This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Everybody, it's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Oh, just terrific.
All right. Well, we are missing Dr. Hawk today, but so I guess it's back to old times, Dr. Lyle.
You got it. All good.
All right. Well, we've got some questions today, and some of them are about behavioral genetics. So Let's just get right to it. Dear Dr. Lyle, I know you propose that personality is 100% genetically driven, But Dr. McDougall has shown that genes can be turned on and off by diet, and that even the DNA of twins may diverge over time If each twin is raised separately on different diets. Mm-hmm. Might the same thing be true of the genes behind our personalities, that certain genes could be switched on or off by environmental impacts? And if so, wouldn't that mean that nurture along with nature does in fact affect personality?
I understand where the people are coming from, and there's like Dr. McDougall is, I've seen his writings on this, and he's showing, obviously, forget the genes. If you have monozygotic twins, and you put them in different environments, so they're going to, for example, eat different food, get different amounts of sunshine, you're one Catholic, one Jewish, you know, one in a gangster family, you're going to have some differences in that person's life experience, and you're going to observe, for example, one of them might be 50 pounds overweight and the other one's 35 pounds overweight. And so we don't need to hypothesize difference that the genes are changing. This is a, this is sort of an understandable human tendency. It's like if you get locked in a prison, The prisoners spend no amount of time for a while thinking how they're going to get out of it. And so I know I worked in a maximum security prison for 10 years, and I watched my mind go through an interesting process, and it went through it for more than a year. I was inherently interested in watching my own mind as it went about trying to solve the problem. And I came up with all possible mechanisms for how I would escape if I was locked down. Because remember, I'm talking to people every day who have life sentences or extremely long sentences. They might as well be life sentences. So I actually came up with the only plausible schemes. And the schemes involved ruses. In other words, the big chance would be to somehow figure out how you would mimic a guard. That if you looked like a guard, and you might be able to, you know, carefully figure out where you could get a uniform or something, or you wouldn't look at a uniform. You'd actually look like a staff. I've actually forgotten my whole thought process, and now I'm recovering it with this question. The way to do it is to look like you're a doctor or a nurse or something like that, find a way to get some clothes that would look somehow like casual clothes, etc. Whatever. In other words, it would be a ruse. You're not going to break through the electrified double fences with guards with guns in the towers. This is not going to happen. And so, and then finally, after about a year, I quit thinking about it. And the reason I quit thinking about it was there was no way to do it. So in the whole history of CDCR, there's been like two escapes. Both of them were from what's called level one. Level one is where you could just hop a fence because it's not electrified. and you're not under a gun. So there's nobody watching the yard with a gun in their hands. So that has actually happened like a couple of times. And I mean, really, the reason why they don't guard people that closely is you only got like a year to go. It's like, hey, dude, like there's no reason to escape. And yet some impulsive people a couple times just couldn't resist and they did it. And so anyway, there's been a few things like that have happened, but essentially you're not escaping. Now, people want to escape the constraints of the genes. So when they start to hear people like Jen and I and Robert Plomin or anybody else, I mean, we're not grouping ourselves with Plomin, but when you start talking to people that know a great deal about genetics and influence on phenotypes or outcomes, and you start looking at what the truth is, you realize, oh, you're in a trap. Okay, you're not getting out. And so your people that ask these questions are essentially like me, my first year on the prison grounds. I'm looking for a way out. And it turns out, ultimately, you look hard enough, you start finding out that there is no way out. Now, so it looks like there is, just like when you look at the prison, it looks like there is. So let's talk about the difference conceptually between, quote, the concept of changing personality or, God forbid, trying to change your genetics through some epigenetic process. And then, therefore, we're going to change our genes and change our personality through some process. It's like, this is a fool's errand. In the same way that, you know, I would have loved to change the shape of my nose. Would have been great, okay? I could tell by 15, oh my God, you know, it was a joke in our family, like, ooh, you got the Fairchild nose. Like, your sister got the Lyle nose. She got a perfectly nice nose. I didn't. I got the Fairchild nose, which has been known for several generations. Such is life, okay? So no matter how much I stared at the mirror, looked sideways, you know, everything I could think of to encourage it not to grow bigger and in the famous Fairchild style, here it is, 60 years later, it's the same damn nose as I was facing to my horror at age 12, okay? So what has changed? Well, my skin's wrinkled, I'm older, you know, I don't have the cardiopulmonary function I did when I was 26. Yeah, a lot of things change. Okay, so in the same way, two people, same genetics, one of them eats a bunch of crap, one of them doesn't. They look different. Okay, so it is. Their genes really haven't changed. You could say, ooh, well, this gene changed here over on that chromosome a little bit, and that one did there too. I don't even know what you mean. The actions of those specific genes have changed, but the person, it's the same underlying genotype. So don't wear yourself out thinking that we're going to somehow change the genes. Now, did the food make an impact on the people's lives? Certainly. Did the gene action, as a result of, you know, how did the genes have to adapt to the different diets? Was there chemical action at the level of the gene? Yeah, every damn meal there was. So, you know, has there been different amounts of damage to the cells? One person smokes, that's all they do, the other one doesn't. They're monozygotic twins. Come back 50 years later, one of them looks like 15 years older than the other one. What's the cause? The genes. There's been genetic damage done by the poison. You know, what are we clapping and calling that a victory for the person who didn't smoke? I wouldn't. It's just that the other person's damaged. So this is I understand when you start to feel the walls close in behind the concept of genetics and change, particularly around personality, you start to feel like, whoa, does this mean I'm stuck with this personality? Can I change my kid to be smarter? No, you can't, okay? If your kid is 125 IQ, above average, bright, university capable kid, but is not freaking Einstein, they're not gonna be Einstein. Doesn't matter where you start the baby Einstein problem. We're not gonna change the genes that are gonna somehow cause a greater amount of conversation in a now growing corpus callosum that's going to make him be able to talk like Jen Hawk. Never going to happen. Okay. No, the genes are constraints. That's what they are. And so the answer is no, there is no substantive change to personality over time. what you see is you see the different manifestations of that personality depending upon the ecological circumstances that it finds itself in. So my nose could look worse if somebody broke it a few times. Okay. The same way your skin could look better or worse depending upon did you be in tanning beds? You know, I'll see young ladies that they want to tan and they're 22 years old and they think they're looking so hot because they're getting their tan, and I'm just rolling my eyes like, oh my God, do you have any idea what you're setting yourself up for at 35? When you're 35, you're going to look 42. And you did it to yourself right there by, you know, putting excessive sun, you know, exposure. So no, the notion is that ecological, you know, inputs can influence the gene environment, you know, gene environment. You are the result of gene environment interaction. Life is the result of gene environment interaction. The genetic code has to do something with the inputs that impact the biochemical material inside the cell that those genes are operating in. Think of the genes as, I don't know, like a little supervisor in there with a code. But, you know, it's like a housing, it's like a building supervisor. But it can only do what it can do with the materials that the factory bring, that they bring them. So if they bring him a bunch of crappy old rotting wood, then he'll build the best house he can with it because that's his genetic construction, but it's not going to look too good. In the same way, if you bring super pristine, excellent hardwood, it's going to build the very best little structures that it can. Okay, so don't call that gene differences. There might even be damage to the genes if we wind up with a bunch of poison inside those cells. And that's true. And we can now hail that and call that epigenesis. You know, the genes have changed. Yeah, they've been damaged. Okay, you're not going to take a pristine, undamaged gene and through some spectacular environmental impact inside the cell, improve its function. No, that will not happen. Okay, so this is why essentially most environmental inputs for most things, including, for example, food, wind up being about the same over time. Two monozygotic twins, whether they're raised together or raised apart, they will pretty much eat the U.S. diet. Now, maybe one won't. Maybe one, you know, there's enough conscientiousness and intelligence in the system that one of them gets a hold of this information and freaking goes gangbusters and does a spectacular job. But let's just forget about the outlier and let's just look at how it really works. So two people, monozygotic twins, and they both have, for example, a lot of fat genes. So let's suppose they're 75th percentile in terms of the how many fat genes that they have. And so now at age 20, they're both like 22 pounds overweight. Not too bad. At age 30, now they're 34 pounds overweight. At age 40, now they're 42 pounds overweight. At age 50, now they're 47. Okay, now we look at the two of them. They live in different areas of the country, but they eat, essentially their environment is basically the same. So whether or not they're eating at McDonald's or they're eating at Wendy's or they're eating at Whataburger in Texas, it's pretty much the same food. And so as their environments are actually functionally equivalent, even though the McDonald's burger is probably higher quality beef than the Whataburger. And now I'll get a letter from the Whataburger people. But the point is that it's functionally equivalent. And so when we see these two people at age 50, we're going to find that their bodies are extremely similar. Now, the fact that sometimes early in life, you're going to find people might be in dramatically different places for a while. So one of them goes to the Peace Corps and they're in Costa Rica and they're eating rice and beans for a year. And they come back and they're lean and fit. Okay, and you look at them and they're like, wow, you guys are identical twins. You know, one of you is 26 pounds overweight and the other is fit as a fiddle. And the reason is that the environments have been substantially different. Is this as a result of genes changing from epigenesis? No, Okay, this is just the fact that the genes had different materials to work with in one condition versus the other. Now we bring that person back to the United States, back to their desk job at the Peace Corps, and now they're eating the standard American diet, probably in all probability. And now we look at them now at age 26, and now they start to converge. Okay, now we look at them at 30, they've converged some more. And one of them has some kind of weird little habit or has a girlfriend and now he's trying to lose weight. So it bounces around, okay? When we see them at age 50, we're going to see that they have converged unbelievably well. And the reason is that the environmental influences have kind of evened themselves out. So at one point, this environment was a little different, then the other one's a little different. We can't tell who's going to be heavier at any point in the equation because somebody's on a diet trying to do things differently, or they get a job change and they got to walk 200 yards to the subway and now they're a little bit better shape for a while. So these little random environmental inputs will cause differences in the outcome. But if we look over time, we're going to find something very interesting. And that is that they will converge. And we can measure this by the correlation coefficient as to how much of the variability that we see in monozygotic twins, for example, at age 60 with respect to their weight. It will be over 80% of the variance will be accounted for by the genetic code. So, in other words, we already knew. If we had measured one of them, we can almost, not perfectly, but almost perfectly map what the other one looks like. That's how powerful the genetic code is, for example, with respect to weight. Now, with respect to personality, we're going to find exactly the same process going on. So we're going to find that one person, you know, for a while is more anxious because they're working under a boss that's an unbelievably stickler and they're really anxious about it. Okay, and they're 23 years old and they're pretty conscientious, but boy, they're under a dragon. The other one is more relaxed and is having a better time at life, and it looks like their personalities are different because the second one isn't under some draconian situation. And so when they meet and they're chit-chatting, they look pretty similar, but one of them looks a little more nervous. And you might say, is this a personality change? And the answer is no. That's not a personality change. They're living in different environments. Okay, so it's like the genes of two people's skin hasn't changed. If two MZ twins, one of them goes to Panama and starts getting a deep tan and the other one's up in Minnesota and isn't getting it, their genes haven't changed. Okay, what's changed is the gene environmental action has changed, and down there's so much sun down there that the genes have to say, we've got to kick out some melanin. We've got to darken this skin to defend ourselves. So the genes haven't changed, but the job they're doing is different. That's called epigenesis. That's the epigenetics. The genes can have a variety of outcomes depending, or they're flexible about what those outcomes can be dependent upon the inputs. So it's going to turn out that with personality, you might say, hey, well, if it's flexible, doesn't that mean the personality can change? No, I didn't say that. I said that the behavioral output that you see at any given moment, it can change fairly dramatically. You can have a real SOB, but you put a gun to his head, sometimes he gets very cooperative, particularly if you shoot three other people right in front of him. Okay, suddenly it's yes, sir, no, sir. Okay, did we change his personality? No, but we changed his behavior as a result of the ecological conditions. It was possible for him to be very respectful. It's just that it's not going to be his typical way he's going to do things. A person with very light-colored skin is not typically going to have darker bronze, but if we put them under different ecological conditions, they may well be able to have quite bronze skin. Okay, so the genes can manifest differences in outcomes. And you might say, well, couldn't that make me more conscientious? Yes, you absolutely can be more conscientious. If we put you under constraints where the cost-benefit analysis is essential for very important outcomes for you to be more conscientious, as soon as we drop that pressure, you're going to go right back to where your monozygotic twin is, who's working for the DMV and is relaxing. Okay, so it's the notion of there's a difference in thinking that the genes have changed versus that the epigenesis of what you're looking at has changed. So you are a flexible organism that can stretch and mold your behavior, and including your waistline, depending upon the environmental inputs, the variance of the environmental inputs. When it comes to personality, it's going to turn out that your psycho-emotional behavioral process in any given point of time can look one way because of pressure from the environment. As soon as that pressure goes back and equals the pressure of your monozygotic twin, it's going to turn out that the two of you are going to converge. So I hope that, you know, it's equivalent of you get a tan and lose a tan and get a tan and lose a tan and get a tan and lose a tan. Okay, the tan, your genes are remaining the same. The outcome of the gene environmental inputs is changing. So that's how that works. So you can get confused, and I just briefly read, and McDougall posted that recently from an old article that he had read. He's probably trying to make the case to say, listen, you're not locked in by your genes, and he doesn't want to hear it. And he's right in for the kinds of things that he's talking about. If you've got the, quote, genes for cardiovascular disease, which you might, if you do, it isn't a death sentence. It just means that you have to have an extremely restrictive, intelligent diet not for that to manifest. Okay? That isn't changing your genes. That's just optimizing your outcome. Remember, we didn't improve your genes there, folks. What we did was we didn't give your genes the bad materials to have a bad outcome. That's different. Okay? So if you're 60, 50, 40, let's say you've got a kid that's 30th percentile conscientious, don't bother trying to pound that kid in with environmental inputs to try to get him to the 50th percentile for conscientiousness. That's a total waste of time. You can put constraints on that person's life, if the government doesn't stop you, to make that kid behave like he's 99th percentile conscientiousness. You understand? You could take out a whip and chains, and you could make that kid terrorize that child into essentially 99th percentile conscientiousness. But as soon as you take that pressure away and you give that kid a reasonable ecological condition, he's going right to the 30th percentile. That's where he's going. Okay, so you can't model it, you can't encourage it, you can't reinforce it, and you cannot change it. All you can do is temporarily modify the outcome that you see as a result of the environmental inputs that you put on the system. That child, if they have a monozygotic twin, also at the 30th percentile for conscientiousness, when you see them hanging out together at a bar when they're 35 years old, their life stories are going to be remarkably similar in terms of the how the conscientiousness equation and where they stand has stacked up. Try put one of them with an unbelievably fastidious accountant family where they scream and rage about, for example, credit reports, all right? Trust me, it won't make any difference. At age 35, the flake brother with a 35th percentile conscientiousness will have no better and no worse credit report than our friend who grew up in a family with intensive scrutiny on credit reports. And I can tell you that there's plenty of evidence to support exactly what I'm saying. In fact, you couldn't tell at the end of that, at the end of 18 years, when you finally let that child go, which child would be more likely to have the higher credit report at age 35. Now, you would be able to predict that at age 18 and a half because the environmental shadow is still hanging over that individual. This is the unbelievable, beautiful research that Plowman reports, that of course the environment looks like it's having an impact early, and so therefore we think, we've got some traction here, okay? But then all you need to do is watch it, and it's going to turn out that the environmental influence will drop to zero. Okay? So by 35, those credit reports are the same. In fact, they're the same by 28. Okay? They're not the same at 19, but they are quickly headed that direction. So that's a long story. If people want sort of, you know, I'm haphazard because I'm winging this question. But if you want a beautiful, comprehensive discussion of this, it's on the new part of our website under the member section is Jen Hawk on personality. So Jen does an hour in four separate intermediate, you know, size lectures that are a beautiful integrated piece on exactly what she and Plowman call the nature of nurture. All right. Go ahead, Nathan.
All right. Thanks so much, Dr. Lyle. And that website, by the way, for our listeners is esteemdynamics.com. All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, though parents don't shape their children's personalities, that time at home can leave all sorts of lasting outcomes, including anything along the spectrum of wonderful to terrible memories, respectful relationships, or bitterness and resentment towards one another, great financial inheritance or debt, and generally, the set of examples and information made available or limited for the child can heavily influence their life choices and performance. After, can't a child and emerging adult only work with the ideas they have available to them? And can't they get set into certain ruts of ideologies and perspectives, including, for example, their religious beliefs?
Good question. So now we're going to rewind this for a minute, and we're going to attempt to remove the distortions from the person's thinking. You have enormous influence as a parent over your children's happiness when they're under your roof. So you can make their life a living hell. You can also make it potentially much better. So you can make it great potentially. So you, just in the same way that anybody in any relationship, particularly one that's effectively forced and has to happen, that you have a lot of influence on what that other person's life experience is. Suppose I have a coworker and we're in some government contract and neither one of us can be fired and neither one of us wants to leave and we can't stand each other. And so I go to work and my behavior and the impact on him is substantial, and his behavior and impact on me is substantial. We have an enormous influence over each other's life experience at that point. Okay, so as a parent, do you have an enormous influence over your child's life experience when they're under your care? Absolutely, you do. Do you have an influence over their personality? None. You have no influence over their personality. So you can't change your 30th percentile conscientious kid to 35. Not going to happen. You can't change your 125 IQ child to 128. Can't happen. Okay. You can't change your 87th percentile introverted child into average so that they can function more easily in society. Not going to happen. You're not going to move it one percentile point. If it looks like you've moved it, as soon as they're out of your care, the pressures that you're putting on them, i.e. get your homework done, get your homework done, get your homework done, okay? As soon as those pressures are removed, that child is going to revert to exactly who it is that they are genetically. Now, the other issue is, so they're saying, is there this heavily influence on their futures? No, you don't have a heavily influence on their future. Life is long, folks. That kid leaves at 18. So a friend of mine left at 18, couldn't stand his dad. They argued all the time. It's very acrimonious. And so he hit the road and joined a rock band and, you know, toured the country and was wild and did all kinds of stuff. Okay. But this guy has two characteristics along with the disagreeable and open. Also is extremely intelligent and highly conscientious. Where did he wind up? He wound up a vice president of a Fortune 50 company in technology. That's where he wound up. Okay? So that's kind of where you would have expected to wind up had you given him a big five in an IQ test when he was 16. Okay? Now, it took a while to get there. Why? Well, his dad and him had an acrimonious situation. His dad, you know, yelled at him and said, "Damn it, you ought to go to law school. You just argue like a lawyer." Okay? And so had the dad been gentle, suave, you know, been more like me and, you know, tried to guide him, would he have had a different existence? Yeah. Would have been bull tall at Berkeley Law School, would have graduated in the middle of his class or maybe probably lower because he, you know, would want to still be partying at 24. And so his career would have looked different. And where would it have been? Well, he would have been counsel for that same Fortune 50 company, you know, 20 years later, instead of the vice president of business development. Oh, well, we're going to call that a big, heavy influence on that child's life? I don't think so. Okay, so your genes, now do opportunities make a difference in life? Does luck make a difference in life? Yes. But how do you know that it's good luck that your parent is stirring you towards something with the very best of intentions and tries to put you in the best school and tries to put you in the best position for success? Does that really mean anything? And the answer is, no, I don't think so. I don't really think it does. The truth is that success is going to come as a result of your diligence and native abilities as you apply them in a competitive marketplace. So, you know, the idea of silver spoon in your mouth and that you have the road paved for success for you, maybe in a few rare cases, but not typically. Most of us are out here fighting it out with our abilities in a competitive marketplace, and it's our intelligence and our conscientiousness and our personality characteristics. The circumstances can put roadblocks in people for a while, and then they will find their way around those roadblocks by essentially competitive necessity. Their nervous system, now, let's face it, that is far more true today than it would have been 50 or 100 years ago. 50 or 100 years ago, important roadblocks would be in people's way that had great talent and they couldn't get past them. They literally couldn't survive, or their skin was the wrong color, or they were the wrong gender. And so there was legitimate obstacles 100 years ago. Today, there are not legitimate obstacles, not obstacles enough to stop anybody. And so as a result of this, it's going to turn out that in a perplexing, frustrating thing for people who believe in the blank slate and learning theory, it's going to turn out that all the evidence indicates that across all measures, the genes are explaining more of the variance in outcomes now than they did 30 years ago. Why? Because the environments are effectively becoming equivalent across people. So this questioner is thinking, well, now, wait a second. What if you inculcate your kid with the right ideas, put him in the right school, give him the right tutoring? Isn't that really paving them the royal road? The answer is no, I don't think so. I think that maybe a little bit short term, but if that kid doesn't have the drive, believe me, it's some other kid is going to make partner. Okay. I went to a law thing, a law review that was a bunch of lawyers up there entertaining each other at an annual thing for a partnership. And there's this gal that sang this song, this sort of sultry song about, you know, making whoopee, and it was called Making Partner. And it was the song was something like, you know, keep your eyes on another python, making partner. Okay. It's like, yeah, that kid didn't come from the fancy school that your dad got you into because you're a legacy, but that guy's a python. And he's going to make partner, and you're not going to make partner if he's 30 percentile more conscientious than you. Okay, so yeah, I disagree with the notion that as parents we have a heavy influence on outcomes. You might have some, and you certainly have some people that get blocked by frustrated opportunities and cost-benefit, you know, challenges come up, and they will be blocked, but they're generally not blocked for a lifetime. It can set them back. It can put them on a different path. It can cost them years, but it's not going to cost them the whole enchilada. There's too many decisions to be made in this lifetime, and there's enough opportunity, and people don't have to worry about literally starving anymore, to the point where the genes are taking over more and more percentage of the variance when it comes to looking at life outcomes. Now, so, and the final part of this is, aren't they bound by the ideas that they have and that you've taught them? No, not at all. The truth is that they will learn new ideas. They will listen. They will be looking to imitate successes in people that have achieved things that they think they might be able to achieve. They will also find themselves reacting to situations in the environment and learning about things that they like and dislike. They can't help it. They are a gene-built machine. And if it turns out that dad really wanted them to be a lawyer because that's where the money was, and by God, if you got financially secure early, that was the key to human happiness. But the kid's a frickin' artist. Okay? They just are. And the kid wants to choreograph on Broadway. And so the truth of the matter is that's where the happiness is going to be, and they're going to find it. You're not going to be able to hide it from them in terms of they're going to be searching for stimuli in the world of human action, and they're going to be trying to find out, where do I fit? What hits me? This is slightly, now I'm not trying to beat up this questioner. This is a very good question and an important one. But this is the sort of the equivalent of thinking, you know what? As a parent, I know how to pick mates for my kids. You know what I mean? I know that my kid, Joanne, should not be marrying Jim. I don't think that's a good match for her. Okay? You know what? You may be right, but you're going to be terrible compared to Joanne picking mates. She may make mistakes, but she knows a hell of a lot more than you do about what turns her on. And so in the same way that parents, you can give them ideas, but they'll reject those ideas if they see better ideas, particularly as it relates to them. So do you have influence on your kids? Yes, you do. You have a great deal of influence over their life experience while they're under you. You also have an influence over their life experience, like every other person does, as you and they age. So if you continue to try to shape your child and be frustrated with them and signal your annoyance that they aren't achieving this or that, or rolling your eyes, then you're going to just be like some critical pain in the ass pressuring friend, and they're not going to like you very much, and you're not going to have a very good relationship. Oh, well. Okay, so so do you have an influence on their life later as adults? Of course you do. What kind of relationship do you have? And the answer is, and it's the one that I hope you have, that I hope that the whole process has been one of a really loving attachment and investment in a great future relationship. And there's going to be vicissitudes and challenges just like there are in all the best of relationships. But are we respectful? Are we thoughtful? Are we also trying to not change them, but rather to inform them about what it is that we know about their environment that they may not know, okay? And that when they learn some the hard way, you know, we put our arms around them and we say, hey, you know, life's got its bumps and bruises, but, you know, you're still here, you can survive, we move on. Okay, this is how we parent, and this is how we are best friends to anybody. So think of these little people as little sovereign creatures who are seeking their own happiness and respectful of their individual differences. And just as when we have conflicts of interest with them, we have every right to impose reasonable rules on them for reasonable demands for their behavior in living in a group setting. And we do. But that doesn't mean change who you are. You know, that's not going to fly. And no matter what we give them, we cannot guarantee any beautiful outcomes for them. They can also find their way. Life finds a way, and so do personalities.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Lyle.
Sure.
Yeah. As you keep talking, I have a few questions, and then I keep listening, and you keep answering the questions. So
okay.
All right.
Our next
question looks like, yeah, our last question. All right. As dear doctors, I'm sold on your, here's another one about behavioral genetics, mm-hmm. but I'm sold okay. on your lucid explanations of how behavioral genetics shapes personality. So doesn't it naturally follow that by going back in time to study differences between the ecological, political, religious influences in different areas of the world throughout our history, that we can use these differences to speculate as to how these differences have shaped personality in different areas of the world? The question is, can you identify or speculate on historical factors that may explain statistical differences in personality between different people?
Yes, beautiful question. Great question, grand question. It's actually a question that has been possibly strategically ignored by very high, you know, brilliant minds in academia that are thoroughly steeped in evolutionary theory, and for good reason. The truth is that this kind of talk is potentially explosive for, you know, on many dimensions. So the blank slate notion that we all come into the world and that we are shaped like silly putty by our environmental impacts, and that's what we become, that is an unbelievably hopeful-looking message, unbelievably democratic and fair. And it basically says, your child could be the next Einstein. Just get to work on, you know, get him a little crossword puzzle kit, except make it with numbers. Okay, so the theory of evolution doesn't necessarily contradict the blank slate. It does, wouldn't in principle, but it starts to give us a little creepy feeling when it starts to say, you know what? It turns out that you can't turn your kid into a giraffe no matter how hard you try. It's not going to think like a giraffe, behave like a giraffe, run like a giraffe. It's just not going to do it. It's not going to eat leaves out of trees. Not going to happen. And that's because its genes have built a brain across a bunch of very tight specifications to make it into a human. And when you start to grasp that, you start to realize, whoa, blank slate's in trouble. You can't start shaping people's behavior that easily. It turns out that it's tightly constrained by the genetic code. Not too far behind that starts to be the notion of, well, wait a second. If the genes build brains in a way that it's tightly specified by species and also, of course, then by gender. So you start to see that, quote, not only are you different than other animals, you're also different from each other in substantial ways depending upon what gender you have, and the difference of the genders is X amount of genes. And you start realizing, okay, well, first of all, notice how much backlash that the notion that the males and females are different has gotten. Like it was on the front of, I don't know, Time magazine or Newsweek or something. Some woman geneticist is saying, oh, no, there's no difference. And a neuroscientist, for God's sake, is just ranting up and down cover of the magazine. No differences. But she's completely wrong. And like just completely ignoring all the data behind nothing other than her own personal political agenda. Not true. Big differences in male and female brains. Substantial differences. Easily akin to the differences you see in male and female hands. If you show me 10 groups of male hands, 10 groups of female hands, I'm going to be pretty good at telling the difference. Will I be perfect? No. There's some effeminate guys out there like me that have really pretty hands. Okay, but a few of us, we would fool a few judges. The brains are the same. Literally looking at the brains anatomically, you can tell the difference about the same level that you can tell hands. Big differences, different ecological forces have shaped those differences. All right, well, we're going to get off of gender. So now we're going to say, well, wait a second. If that's true, which it is, and we can see the differences, which are substantial, we can also see huge overlaps, of course. But when you look at the interests and passions of males and females, there are substantial differences between those things. And those mimic the specialization of labor and survival and reproductive strategies of those two genders across the last several million years. Of course. Okay, now, in the same way, the question then arises, what about different peoples living in different places? What if you're living in Southeast Asia? Do you face the same ecological pressures that you living in Greenland? And the answer is no, you don't. You face many, many similar pressures, of course, but you face substantially different ecologies. As a result, we would expect that the same brain that would do well in Greenland may be somewhat different in terms of its likes, propensities, etc., than the brain that evolves in Southeast Asia. Of course, look at the structure of the bodies. The bodies are structured somewhat differently. Are they mostly the same? Of course they're mostly the same. Are they somewhat different? Yes. Can you tell the difference? Of course you can. Is race a social construct? Absolutely not. These are genetic variances. They're extremely obvious. We can blow off the notion of a social construct by putting it under the genetic code and identifying it. You can find out where the heck your genes came from. You could pinpoint it on a map, apparently within 25 miles, back to your great-grandparents. So the point is that different peoples on different continents and even different places on different continents evolved under different conditions, and those led to different changes in their bodies. And we know what that means. When the bodies of one animal looks different than the body of another animal, we know that their behavior is going to be different. An aardvark isn't the same as a raccoon. They have different ecological problems to solve, and therefore they have different brains. And it's true that the male and the female do not look the same. They have different reproductive problems, and therefore they have different brains associated with the parts of their life that have to do with those problems and how they're different. Of course that would be true. And therefore it's also going to be the case that, of course, people that evolved in different places on the globe are going to have somewhat, are they largely the same? Of course they are. Are there substantial differences? Well, are the bodies substantially different? Ask yourself that. And the answer is yes, they are substantially different. Well, if they're substantially different, would we expect that the big five, in other words, psychological characteristics, we would expect averages to be different in different places on the globe? Yes, we would. In fact, it would be unbelievably astounding if it wasn't the case. Do you really think that if we were to have an Olympic Games, that we should expect that people that have been in Alaska for the last 10,000 years would have the same ability to run 100 meters as people who have been in the Congo? I don't think we would. We have a different ecological problem. Do we think that the people that are in the Congo would be able to stand up to the problems of ice fishing easily? Could they stand the low temperature? Could they get locked in a freezer at 30 below and be okay for an hour and a half? I don't think so. They're going to lose temperature more easily. They're designed to wick that temperature away from heat. They're not designed to conserve it. So the point is that we would, because the bodies are different, we would expect the minds to be different. Would they be largely the same? Of course they would be largely the same. Would we expect general average differences, continental differences? Of course we would. And there are. Okay. This question is, as you can imagine, very touchy when it comes to political issues. So that's why I don't get into it. Okay, I'm not interested. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. We're not ranking these people or better than these people. I'm just going to say, look, there is different ecological conditions. Like, what do you find more beautiful personally? Do you find African people more beautifully? Do you find Northern Asians, Southern Asians, Northern Europeans, Mediterranean? I find, believe me, I'm heterosexual. I find women from all over the world of every race, creed, and color. If they're gorgeous, they're gorgeous. And quite frankly, I have no preference. I just have a preference for beauty. Sorry, just a complete, that's it. I couldn't care less personally anything about the superficial characteristics of the skin or it's just beauty, man. And beauty makes me weak in the knees in any form. Okay, now, so I'm not interested in what inevitably happens with people. They start rank ordering and putting these up and higher and those lower and that's on the side. Forget it, not interested. Are there differences? You bet there are differences. Those differences were beautifully explored by a fine writer, fine science writer by the name of Nicholas Wade. And his book, I think, was about 2012. I think it's called A Troublesome Inheritance. And so also this was revisited much more recently this year by Charles Murray in a book called Human Diversity. Their thinking is a lot of times not comfortable. It's a little disturbing. I can't even remember what it is that I read other than it's obviously true. I expect to see different kinds of talents and propensity. Put it this way, there's somebody from Northern Alaska, and that's where their ancestors are from, who is damn fast. Trust me, they're up there. And they're a lot faster than me, right? So it doesn't mean that if you're a member of a group and your group on average is lower in some ability than some other group, that means that assigns anything to you. Forget it. That would be racial prejudice, for example. But the notion that there are average differences, that men on average are interested in building things and nailing things into a wall and having monster trucks and stuff like that, that doesn't mean you can't find a girl who loves monster trucks. And if you have one, for goodness sakes, don't try to turn her into a little girl with a twirly dress. Let her play with monster trucks. That's who she is. Okay. But on average, do men want monster trucks and girls want twirling little dresses? Yes. And that's not socialized. That's innate due to gene differences. So the so I will leave the teaching of that particular firestorm to Mr. Wade and Mr. Murray. And but hopefully I introduced the topic in a way that we can feel the threat of prejudice and fear over sounding prejudice, when in fact we can look at this from a scientific point of view, shrug our shoulders, and acknowledge the obvious, that people around the world are vastly similar because they're the same species, but in different locations, everywhere, we're going to find, number one, locations on average will have average differences, both in physical presentation and in psychological presentation, and individual differences within those groups are also very substantial. So two people from France whose ancestors grew up 20 miles from each other and have a lot of the same genes, those two people can be very different. One of them can be artistic and funny and outgoing, and the other one can be a little nerd that just wants to learn how a steam engine works. So the genetic diversity within populations is huge. The genetic diversity between populations is notable, interesting, and can be important, just as genetic differences of all kinds can be important. All right.
Wow. Dr. Lyle, thank you so much.
All right. All right. That's enough on that for a while. And next week, we'll make sure we drag Jen back from her little bowls of cherries and smooching with Dr. Greger.
I really do hope they're having a wonderful time. If you guys want to hear more of Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, and you are doing a live Q&A once in a while on Sundays.
Yes.
But you can check all that out if you become a member at esteemdynamics.com.
Very good. All right, Nathan, thanks for having me again, and we'll have the whole team together very soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.